Today, our guest on the Owner's Table podcast, a guy named Trent Dilfer. Now, depending on where you are in the world, the name Trent Dilfer will mean a number of different things. So he played in the NFL 14 years, has a, one of probably only 40 guys-ish that has a Super Bowl ring as a quarterback, was an analyst on ESPN, but then now is a head football coach at UAB. We're going to go down the road of like the NFL days, the analyst days, then college football. Also, the hot topic these days is NIL. How that's changing on an hourly rate, and what his opinion is based off of that, and how he's navigating that with UAB and into the future. Trent, thanks for being here.
I'm fired up. Let's go.
Awesome.
Let's do this.
So we're going to start with the analyst days. So your tenure as an analyst on ESPN, how did that transition into your coaching philosophy?
It did. I got to take it back just a little bit for context.
Yeah.
My last year in the NFL was 2007, okay. And really the last 4 years of my career, I was more of a player's coach. My body had broken down, multiple injuries. Man, if I went down the list, it would take half the podcast. But I was valued more for my brain, football acumen than my body. The skill, if I was a 9 when I came out in the draft on a scale of 1 to 10 athletically, I'd become a 4 or 5.
Wow.
As my dad would tell me, like, you can't get out of your own way. You're going to hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. And I did. I ended up, my career ended on my 14th concussion, was knocked out cold for 3.5 minutes in San Francisco in front of my 3 daughters and wife. They thought I was dead. So, like, I'm done playing football.
Sure.
Well, the Niners wanted me to transition into management role. They wanted to make me the assistant GM. I got offered some NFL coaching jobs. And, you know, if coaching was my ambition at the time, you would say now as an idiot not to do it. But that was not my ambition. You know, my family chased me around.
Sure.
This whole time. And as my wife said, it was my time to chase them around.
Yeah.
So I went into TV with that reason. I really went into TV because I felt like the game needed to be taught to the fan better. I always said this. You will enjoy football more if you know more about it. I always hear this about hockey, and I would say I fall into this. I love hockey. I think it's a really cool sport. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it.
No.
Therefore, I can't sit there and watch a hockey game and appreciate it the same as I could appreciate golf or football or basketball,
right.
Things I know a lot about. Volleyball.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation, dad of volleyball yeah. players. But I felt like if the moms and the grandmas and the sisters and the casual businessman that isn't an NFL junkie, teenage boys, if they started better understanding football, they'd enjoy it more and it would help grow the game. And so I went into football with kind of that teaching hat on, into TV with that teaching hat on. And in the early days, I vividly remember sitting there and taking a subject that I knew we were going to talk about on a show and be like, how could I take this highly complex thing and condense it into a language, into a nomenclature, into a story that if my wife was cooking dinner and listened to it, go, oh, that piques my interest. I want to listen to that bald dude
right.
talk about this. And so I loved that part of it. And as I started doing it, I started having to dive deep into all three levels. In fact, I think at one point, I don't know this to be true, but I don't know if anybody else would have been close to this. I was having to be an expert in all three levels of football. High school, because I was running the Elite 11, the world's biggest camp, mm-hmm. and having to evaluate high school players and learn the high school landscape. College, because one, we were talking about it some, I was calling some college games, as well as the Elite 11 dealing with the Nick Sabans and the Dabo Sweeneys and the Ryan Days and the Chip Kellys right. and all these people because they were recruiting the quarterbacks right. from the Elite 11, and yet I was being paid to talk about the NFL. So I'm studying all three levels of football. And I remember saying this years ago that I remember seeing that everybody said the pro game was trickling down to college, trickling down to high school. And I saw the exact opposite. I saw the high school game trickling up to college, trickling up to the NFL. And if you look at the innovation of football right now, you could trace it right back to Texas, Ohio, Florida, California high school football.
I think I know what you're going to say here. What coach do you think had the most impact on that?
Oh, gosh. I think Browse had an impact.
Okay.
There's others. Man, this goes actually back probably before I started doing TV. You started seeing some trends of this. Some of the air raid guys out
That's
of Texas.
I'm
telling
you.
A lot of air raid guys out of Texas.
The guy that doesn't get as much credit is Hal Mumme.
Hal, absolutely. I'll tell you.
To you and me, he does.
Jeff Traylor, who's in our conference, you know, at UTSA?
Yeah. Yeah.
What he was doing in high school football as an offensive guy has trickled up.
In Texas.
Yeah. So, I mean, he won multiple state championships. When I lived in Texas, and I'll get to a piece of this, that's when I retired from TV. I actually retired and said, I'm never going to work again. I'm going to live in Austin. And I couldn't do that. It was horrible. But I went and started studying high school football in my opinion, the state that kind of innovates high school.
No question. I agree.
Football the most. And you could see stuff like, wait a second, how long have you been doing that? I've been doing that for 20 years. I'm like, well, the NFL just started that 4 years ago. So I saw that. So long-winded Dilfer answer to your question. I started doing this as an analyst. I'm like, huh, I'm a teacher by nature. I really didn't love TV. I love the life it brought me. I love some of the people I worked with. Oh, my gosh.
Were the hours in TV a lot?
No, they're the best thing ever.
Was it
I worked
really?
40 days a year and made a ton of money. And then I commuted from the West Coast. I had red eye from SFO into New York, car service up to Bristol, not sleep for 2 days. You know, I'd work all day Sunday, go back in a car service, go back down to New York after the late Sports Center Sunday night, so 1 a.m. to call it, 3:30 a.m., get to a hotel, sleep for a couple hours, jump on the first flight to Monday Night Football, do the Monday Night Football production meeting, do the show Monday night, and either fly back that night after the game private or fly back commercial the next morning. I mean, I did that for 9 years.
So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
I was a dad. I was Saturday. I didn't miss very much. It was a great lifestyle. I love the life it afforded me.
Wow. That is pretty incredible.
But it didn't have a win and a loss. It didn't have purpose, you know? And so my coaching philosophy after watching all this and then retiring and getting kind of away from football to a certain degree, the one thing I noticed more than anything else in my time there was the amount of bodies left on the street because of coaches. Good people, good players, good athletes, underdeveloped holistically. And we started seeing at the Elite 11, but I really started seeing, there's a lot of great coaches. I'm not knocking coaching.
No.
But what happened was you saw so many kids, because I saw them when they were young, and they should have made it. And they were, for whatever reason, they weren't developed holistically. Their identity became about, did I catch it? Did I drop it? Did I block them? Did I not block them? Did I complete it? Did I not complete it? Did I tackle them? Did I not tackle them? Right? This performance-driven society that was like, almost like the fast food culture. Like, I want it now. You better be good right now. And if you're not, I'm done with you. I'll move to the next thing.
Right.
And I didn't grow up that way. I'm a son of a coach. Yeah. And the development piece, outside of a few guys, I do say Nick Saban, he's the greatest, but he was also the greatest developer. Not just the greatest recruiter, he's the greatest developer. But like, there were some that were developing really well, but there was a lot that just weren't developing in the college and pro game. And I'm like, if I ever got into coaching, because during my time at ESPN, I turned down multiple college jobs and NFL jobs because I just didn't have an appetite
sure.
for it. But what gave me an appetite and what eventually became the calling to coach was this player-centric, I want to get the – and I heard a person say this, and I'll never forget. I truly think it's the definition of coaching of getting the most from the least and the best from the best. Some can get the best from the best. Some high school coaches can get the most from the least. The art is, can you do both?
Can you do both?
Can you recruit the five-star and right. turn him into a Hall of Famer?
Right.
And can you recruit the guy that can't walk and chew gum but has potential and turn him into a contributor?
To a player.
Make them the best of what God designed them to be, and that's what fired me up. I woke up one morning. I felt called to coaching. The hair on my arm was tingling. I felt the voice of God in a church pew say, why do you keep saying no? And I said, this is what I'm going to say yes to. I'm going to say yes to helping people reach their God-given potential.
So one of the most important people in my life, my dad was obviously a coach for 27 years in state, Hall of Fame in the state of Alabama. But he is probably one, and the other guy's 1A is a guy named Jeff Smith. He's still coaching the state of Alabama. Has probably the most impact on me ever. Who is the number one coach that had the most impact on you at any level?
Most impact would be Clyde Christensen. He's kind of my football hero. Clyde, unfortunately, after he coached me, I had to go coach these other duds named Peyton Manning, Andrew Luck, Tom Brady, Matthew Hasselbeck. I mean, it was a total buzzkill from him.
Total drop-off.
Yeah, total drop-off after me. But Clyde, And I do have to pay some. Jeff Tedford, I was the first of his six first-round quarterbacks that he developed. My head coach in college, Jim Sweeney, they kind of taught me the football toughness. I think there's you have to be a tough guy mentally and physically to play this game at a high level and to endure. They taught me that. But Clyde taught me the thing that I think is most important, which is how to be a great son, meaning son to our Lord and Savior,
right,
and a great father to my kids. He was a great coach. Sometimes when I talk about Clyde, I go, he's just a great man. No, he was a great coach. Great football coach.
You don't stay in the NFL that long.
And coach those people.
And coach those dudes.
And those dudes will tell you their best coach was him. But he taught me. He had three daughters. He taught me how to be a father to daughters. He taught me how to love my wife unconditionally. I mean, him and Debbie's marriage is a light to any young couple watching. I mean, we're a young married couple, and we get to see them.
Right.
Every day, and the times he got to pull me aside and just teach me life, he developed me wholly, you know, like within,
what you're talking about,
inside out. Yes, everybody's using this. Is it transactional? Is it transformational? And it's cool. I'm glad people are saying that. But like before, it had a term. It was just I'm teaching the human. I'm gonna coach the human, and Clyde coached the human in me. I remember the day that Tampa decided they weren't gonna re-up me at a. I had this massive escalator bonus due, otherwise I'm going to become free agent. And they decided I wasn't worth it, which I wasn't. They made a good decision. And he sat there and cried with me, like just brokenhearted crying with me because of how much he knew I'd given to Tampa for 6 years, what he saw me endure. You know, we knew we were about, we had just gotten the NFC Championship game. We knew we were going to win a Super Bowl at some point with that group. And I wasn't going to be able to be a part of it. But just his care for me. And to this day, I mean, to this day, he cares more about how our marriage is going, how the girls are doing, than whether we won or lost a game.
I've heard so many good things about Clyde. He was there 1 year when we went, when I was coaching in college at Black Mountain. I mean, you've probably been there.
He goes every year at Black Mountain.
Goes every year.
He was a legend at Black
Mountain. Oh, he's unbelievable. So let's transition to the NFL. Who was your favorite teammate? That's a hard question. That's 14 years and hundreds of thousands of dudes.
I'm going to use impactful instead of favorite.
That's good.
Because he was not my favorite at all, and I was not his. But Matthew Hasselbeck.
Why so?
Without doing another long answer, we competed for the starting quarterback job position. We did not like each other early on. I was a Super Bowl winner. He was an entitled little brat that had never done anything in the NFL except play good in preseason.
Right.
And then he loses, I win. And then I get hurt, and he plays. And we're raising kids that are old. They're having babies. We have toddlers and elementary school kids. And, you know, Sarah, his wife, and my wife kind of become friends, even though we're not friends. And then we kind of develop this respect relationship. And it blossoms into a friendship. And then, and I don't know how much you want to get in this part of my story, but we lost our son when he was 5 and a half, our second born. And in the midst of the worst thing a family could go through, Matt and I had a good relationship, developed a great relationship.
Wow.
And he loved me like a brother through that.
Yeah.
And then I was able to pay that back to him by how I mentored and sacrificed for him as he became the starting quarterback there. And I was coming off this a massive injury. I'd ruptured my Achilles and lost my son, trying to come back and play football again. And just this dynamic that was so beautiful, how God kind of took two people that were polar opposites and kind of butting heads and made brothers out of us really through him.
Wow.
You know, it was really through our mutual love for Jesus that allowed us to come together and be brothers on the football field. And to this day, I mean, a few weeks ago, we were at a conference together. We both sit on the board of a ministry, and just anytime we get time with them, we cherish it because they're truly as close as any, we're as close to them as any NFL relationship can be.
I tell people this all the time, and you don't understand it until you have kids. The friends you have when you raise your kids are the friends you have
forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
Because the help,
yes,
the trials, all those different things, that builds a bond more than anything. Because the friends I have from college and the friends you have from college are probably pretty tight. The friends you have from the locker room are extremely. But the couple friends that you have when you have kids together, it's really kind of – because we have friends from Tennessee that we haven't been there in 8 years, Trent. And they're still our best friends.
Yeah, well, it's because it's hard.
It's hard.
You know, I think, you know, I think at the edge of uncomfortable is where you find greatness. I think doing hard things equals great things. Those are my core philosophies. But if you look at raising kids, it's one of the hardest things you can do. You're never comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't care how good you think you are at this. It's not like you roll out of bed and have all the answers. There's always another thing.
Your kids are gone and you still are dealing with kids. Yeah.
So you're doing this together.
Yeah.
You're walking through this uncomfortable valley of hard things together. Yeah. Therefore, you develop closeness. You develop this greatness in your relationships. And I think it's true for most people that take parenting serious. Mm-hmm. Now, there's this group of people that don't take parenting serious, and they're going to point to their jobs, their careers, probably where their friendships are molded the most. But for parents that are taking this serious, like, this is our lasting legacy.
Sure.
What we leave with them is what lasts. You're going on that journey with other people, and you're going to be, I call it tribal.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have that tribal relationship with them forever.
Who do you call when you're hurting?
Matthew, Steve Stenstrom, another great friend, NFL friend, Todd Peterson, another NFL great friend, Clyde.
Yeah.
I've called Clyde. And when we lost our son, Clyde was working with the Colts at the time, and we had what was called Camp Trevin. Trevin was my son's name at Lucille Packard Hospital in the Bay Area. Clyde literally left the Colts and came out and lived with us in the hospital, and would take Delaney, our youngest, who was a baby at the time, and take her like for 3, 4, 5, 6 hour walks through Stanford and just take her off our hands. And that's how he served us. Wow. He would sit there and pray with us at night as our son was on life support in ICU. The same group of people that I've kind of walked through the valleys of life with, it's still ones I rely on to this day. It is.
It's a small group.
Intimate, yes.
Let's talk a little football. What systems were you in? I'm going to get a little technical, so this is probably going
to
bore people. What systems were you in when you were playing?
Well, everybody thinks I'm this offensive guy to start because I was a quarterback. And I devote most of my time at UAB to offense. But I grew up in some great defensive systems.
Okay.
You know, part of that Bucs defense, I learned Tampa 2 defense from Monty Kiffin. And Tony Dungy, who invented it.
Yeah.
So I sat in their cubicles at One Buck Place and learned every rule of Tampa 2 defense and 3 buzz and 3 insert and Fox and overload strong and weak and all the compliments to it. And then Baltimore, the greatest defense of all time, we won a Super Bowl with.
Yeah.
So got the Marvin Lewis, Jack Del Rio, Rex Ryan iterations of defense. They were all on the same staff. So those are kind of the defensive systems I'm most familiar based. I think playing a too high shell with a dominant defensive front and letting linebackers roam to make tackles is the best way to play defensive football. I think that's the thing they both had in common.
Right.
Marvin's more of a 2-gap guy. Monty, Tony more of 1-gap. At the end of the day, they want their linebackers to run and make plays.
To be free.
Defense to either create havoc vertically or horizontally by 2-gapping. And then staying in 2-high shell as much as possible and be able to stop the run that way.
Yeah.
You don't want to bring extra pressure unless you have to, yada, yada, yada. So that's
people think that those guys were big blitzers and they weren't.
No. They're tight. You know, they I always use the pitch analogy. Their fastball was 2-high shell zone. Right.
Which that was so boring.
That was their 98-mile-per-hour fastball.
Yeah.
But boy, when they broke that thing off on the breaking ball, that was a weak side blitz. Or they throw that 4-finger change.
Yeah.
It looks like a fastball coming out. That was the other blitz. So they're impactful blitzers.
Sure.
They're the strikeout pitches.
Yeah.
Using the pitching analogy. Offensively, I have a really diverse shot. This would take all day. I would say I grew up conservatively, son of an offensive line coach. Became aggressive, Jeff Tedford, Jim Sweeney, reverted back to a conservative nature in Tampa, the kind of the ground and pound days, that Baltimore.
Who is your coordinator in Tampa?
Mike Shula. Mike Shula, Tony hired Mike, very vanilla, boring, eye back.
People in Birmingham know.
Yep, non-innovative. But, I mean,
no.
There you could win with it if you played great defense. Baltimore, we weren't as boring, but still equally conservative. And then I had West Coast roots through this.
Okay.
Because I was always a student of the game. So I was always studying the game in the offseason. Mm-hmm. I was enamored by what Holmgren was doing. Yep. I had a relationship with Bill Walsh, so I could go back and kind of dip into that relationship.
Did you ever play in it?
So I went to Seattle and I played for Holmgren.
You did. That's right.
And that is where I think it all came together. The whys of offensive football came together. Studied a lot of Mike Martz, then got to play for Norv Turner.
Oh,
so
wow.
Norv was one more element to kind of piece it all together. Mm-hmm. You know, his kind of San Diego Chargers background, how Norv grew up, then the Cowboys.
Yeah.
And he had started combining some West Coast philosophies to his numbering tree and his vertical passing game.
So Norv was a digit guy. Is that correct?
He was a digit guy, and he was more run vertical pass.
Okay.
Where the West Coast was more run the ball through passing it and maintain a balanced run game. But your run game opens up because you're kind of stretching. You're using 53
horizontal
yards.
Yep.
Yep. You're using 53 yards.
Yep.
So I started tying it all together. You know what I call my philosophy now is get the dude the ball.
Yeah.
You know, really, it really, but there's so many ways of getting him. And I would say it's a both and world now.
Yeah.
Like you no longer, like people have learned how to defend the air raid. People have learned how to defend these power backfields.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard when you're a both and. Can you play four open and can you play 22 personnel?
Sure.
Can you stretch the field horizontally with the quick passing game, the screen game, and the misdirection game? And can you attack them vertically? Can you still dominate the A gaps in the run game? You know, I look at more now of what conflict can we bring to the defense. And if you can break their rules, if you can ruin their practices, if you can ruin their sidelines with what they're having to adjust to, you've won half the battle. Now you got to get your players to execute in the midst of that.
Right.
But there's a lot of tools now in the offensive tool belt that you can use to disrupt a defense, make them eat their soup left-handed,
sure,
so to speak.
Yeah.
And gain a distinct advantage offensively without having to overload volume.
Has the game changed to where the schematic part is causing defenses more problems, or is it still their dudes are better than your dudes?
Okay, so I think offense has a tremendous advantage.
Oh, of course.
Like it's
always has.
Yeah, the rules have just changed so much to where it's very hard to play defensive football. The athletes on the defensive front are like we've never seen before at
our
level, even at the group of five level. Four guys up front on the defense can still trump any scheme. So that's where the SEC really does. If you just want to make college football very simple, it's the four guys up front in the SEC.
I think the Power Four have simplified.
Yeah. Go get the best four guys up front. I mean, you look at Michigan's run, yeah, Graham and those guys. Go back and trace any of these national championship dominant teams. It's going to start with the four defensive linemen. Because it allows you to be safe.
Yes.
Keep
everything in front of you.
Play umbrella defense and keep everything in front.
Let them do all this stuff.
Yep. Because if you can't use those four, now you have to respond to all the stuff we do.
Correct.
You have to not respond. You have to react to what we do. Because you can never have – you can never be a hat short. And we're always trying to get you in a position where you're a hat short or you're misaligned, where you can create an edge on the defense or a soft spot in the defense. Because so much is two plays built in one. We have plays that are three plays built in one. The quarterback can handle so much seed gap read, midline read, second level RPO, you know, horizontal stretch reads. Like we can stretch you so thin that if you don't have four dudes up front that can just dominate the game, the offense has the total advantage.
Here's the thing. You've got a superior athlete on the defensive line,
mm-hmm,
and you've got the worst athlete on the field,
mm-hmm,
on the offensive line, and he's going backwards, and you're going forwards.
Yes.
But to talk about your hat on a hat philosophy, even if you've got a hat for a hat or even if you've got one plus, one of those four guys beats your guy, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. I agree.
It doesn't matter. And that's where the difference, like you said, that's where the difference is we got it. You look at Alex. Hey, Alex, we got him. But then all of a sudden, the three.
Happens all the time.
Screws everything up. Yeah. And you got 10 other dudes doing things right, but that three couldn't get blocked.
You mentioned Alex. I think he's one of the greatest.
Oh, I love
him. He's one of the greatest minds in offensive football. And me and him will be talking on the phones in a game. And very rarely is he wrong. Very rarely is Alex Morton wrong on what's going to work. But what we can't predict is what's going to happen up front.
Sure.
But, like, there's grass. There's all the grass we're trying to get is usually there, you know, based on either the way we game plan or how we're calling it in the game. It's the execution piece. Usually, can we handle the line of scrimmage?
Sure.
Now, I will say this. The one thing that is kind of coming into vogue, and we did this to UConn last year, if you want to watch this, is there's now tools where you can neutralize those players. You don't have to block them.
Don't block them.
Sometimes you just don't block them.
Sixth grade football.
Though. Yeah. We're going to get an NIL, and you're going to see – quarterbacks are always going to make the most, but defensive linemen are going to make the second most.
Sure.
I have a great story on that. You said the worst player on the field. I'm not going to use names because I don't want to embarrass this person. I don't want anybody to try to figure out who it is. But I was recently at a Christian conference, this board I was telling you about, and I was sitting with an offensive line. I'm not going to tell you what team he plays for, but he's been in the league for 7 years. He's made two Pro Bowls, I think.
Wow.
He's made two, maybe three Pro Bowls. And we're sitting back in the break of a session, having lunch together, and his other offensive line buddy plays with him on the same team was there. And I'm like, guys, tell me about what the challenges are today in the NFL line of scrimmage play. And he said, well, I'll put it this easily. I think he's been to three Pro Bowls. He goes, I've been to three Pro Bowls, and every week for 17 weeks, I look at their two deep on the defensive line. And every single week, I'm an inferior athlete to all eight defensive linemen for 17 straight weeks, for seven straight years.
Every day I go to work.
He goes, I am an inferior. And this guy is a beast now. He
Pro
is
Bowls.
Lean. Yeah. He is strong. He is long. I'm like, well, how do you win? Discipline.
Yeah.
Eyes, hand placement, foot placement, timing. Knowing what he's supposed to do before he does it, like all these intellectual and nuanced things.
Yeah.
And he's like, I have to be perfect. I have to play 66 plays and I got to be perfect with my hand placement. I use these little tools. He showed me this thing. I'd never say I'm a son of offensive line coach, but he showed me this thing. We call it length to strength. When you can get in a triple extension and have your length, that's your strongest position to block. And he goes, now this new thing is if I can get him right up here in the shoulder pad area, if I can get him and I can pronate my wrist the right way. He goes, and he did it to me. He goes, trying to move. And I couldn't move. He goes, I just found this tool 2 years ago. And I can just stone these dudes that are better athletes with me. But I'm like, this is real time, real speed. You have to punch the guy perfectly. You got your feet. You got to be square. And now you got to get in there and rotate your
and
wrist.
And he's running full speed.
And he's running full speed. And the guy is 6'4 and a half, 318 with 12% body fat, runs a 4.79 and probably verts 34 inches.
But what you're saying is this, and this is for all athletes. So this is just not for an inferior athlete. Basics done right over time is how you win.
Amen. Amen.
Basics done right. And you were talking about a hand placement and a not even a full twitch of the wrist. Mm-hmm. And this guy's figured out that tool. And so if they can, whatever position, the basics done right is what's going to
win. You can
get
me in this conversation all the time. I think the biggest lie right now out there, and it's the Instagram highlight video generation, is that talent wins.
I heard, you know what's so funny you say that. I heard this the other day.
So many talented. Now, again, talent with technique, talent with discipline, talent with great acumen, talent with being able to stay calm in the storm. Yeah, yes, obviously talent's going to win. But a nine talent with no technique, no discipline, no nuance to his game, six talent with all the other stuff, the six will kick the nines, you know what.
Every time.
Everybody looks at the vertical leap, the one. I told my team the other day, I'm like, I'm gonna say a name out loud and everybody tell me what you think. And I said, Odell Beckham Jr. And I said, oh, the one-handed catch, blah, blah, blah. The highlight stuff, right? I said, what's he doing right now?
Yeah. Got accused of rape.
I'm like, the guys that play 10, 12, 14 years, the guys now that are making not just $30 million. Guys are making $150, $200, $250 million on the length of their second, third, fourth contracts.
Yeah.
aren't the most talented guys. Mm-mm. Those most disciplined guys. Those most guys play the best technique. Those guys play the best effort.
What's the guy Tampa this past year? He said he 9 years in a row, 1,000 yards, 10 years in a row.
Mike Evans?
Mike Evans.
Yeah.
Mike Evans has highlights, but yes. Mike Evans' highlights are routine things yes. done great.
Yes. Yes, and he was a guy that was a run fast, jump high guy at Texas A&M. Johnny Manziel, yeah. jump balls.
Right.
People weren't sure how he was going to translate to the NFL. His receiver coach, little shout out to UAB here, his receiver coach that really molded him in Tampa, Kevin Garver, Birmingham resident, my wide receiver coach.
I know Kevin.
So Kevin got Mike to buy into the professionalism, the craft of wide receiver play while he was there in Tampa.
Yeah.
Mike was a great talent. He is a nine
Huge.
Talent.
Absolutely.
That played with probably 6, 7, let's just call it technique, but then said, wait a second, I want to be a Hall of Famer. And he matched his nine yep. talent to his nine technique discipline, wow. and now he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. And Kevin had a ton to do with that.
Wow. Kevin's dad is my financial advisor, by the way. So we know that they're great guys.
You're printing money.
Yeah, they're great guys. Okay, so we're talking about money. So NFL has this – I tell people this all the time. The people, the guys that play in the NFL and make lots of money, they make great money.
Mm-hmm.
But the money compared to someone that is a CFO or a CEO of some of these big, it's really not that much. Mm-hmm. But the money that the NFL's guys can make can, as you said before already, can set you up for life.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them it doesn't.
Yeah.
But a lot of them it does. How did you invest when you were making money for those 14 years in the NFL?
Okay, so the smartest thing I did was hire a business manager early. Not a financial advisor. He helped me hire my financial advisors. He helped me hire my lawyers. He helped me hire my agents. But he was Joe Montana's, lack of a better term, endorsement guy.
Okay.
I did marketing for Joe Montana. And Joe was coming to the end of his career. I remember, I'll never forget, you get a call from Joe Montana when you're in college and on a rotary phone.
That's right. Look that up, kids, rotary phone.
I'm like, hello, it's Joe Montana? No, it's not. Come on.
No.
And it really was like, hey, you really need to look into this because you're about to get paid a ton of money, have a long career, and this guy can really protect you from a lot of stuff. So his name's H. Cole, lives in the Bay Area. I think we're on 31 years together this year. And his approach was always be highly, highly conservative. Create enough where we could have luxury in our life.
Sure.
And not say no to things and raise our kids and do cool stuff, but really set ourselves up, you know, generationally. Best thing I did, to be honest with you, is about $1 million annuity in 94. You know, long-term annuity.
Yeah.
That's probably the best thing I did. But a lot of long-term conservative investments, life insurance, being conservative in the stock market, staying away from these get rich quick schemes. Now, I will say this, although he saved me millions of dollars by stopping me from getting into some of these things, there's some things we've missed on, and you got to be willing to miss on those things. I can think of a franchise that I could have become owned 12 or 13 of them right off jump that, you know, I'd be worth 30x what I am now. I can think of some land deals and some very nice areas that, you know,
I passed on.
But I can think of just the litany of deals I was offered that we said no to. So very comfortable with our long-term investment strategy. We're very, you know, just as believers, we've always believed in giving,
being absolutely
absurdly generous to kingdom purposed projects. So I am a true believer, and most people probably disagree with me with this, but that's fine. You know, we try to give away a majority of our wealth to kingdom purposes. I believe our rewards aren't in our bank accounts when we die, but in heaven when we go see the Lord. So that's a big part of what we've done. And I try to tell kids now that these college kids are getting money, I'm like, just, you know, the safest bet is just be ultra, ultra conservative until you know a little bit more.
Sure.
And then the other thing I tried not to do, I try not to be an expert in something I'm not an expert in. I try not to pretend like I knew finance. I didn't get a finance degree. Yeah. I don't have financial training. So many professional athletes think they need to look smart by understanding how to make their money work for them. No, you hire people to do that.
Yeah. Be great at what you do.
Be great at what, go play football better.
Yeah.
Make more money. Sure. Right? And then let smart people work with you and educate you on how to do that. So many professional athletes in my era thought, I think it was an insecurity. You know, it was like, well, I should know this, so I'm going to pretend.
I'm going to protect myself.
Yeah. And I was like, no, you're killing yourself right now because you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, and I was lucky. I got good advice early on to get H, and H was always that barrier for me. He was always, hey, Trent, you go play football. I'll make sure you don't get in trouble.
What's the number one biggest financial mistake that you made?
Car dealership. So John Elway became a friend.
That was the fastest answer in the history of 90 episodes.
Lost $2 million in like 3 months. And that could have been $7 million if I wasn't bailed out by a guy
car dealership.
Who wanted my name right. So Elway got me, Elway and his agent, and it was not a bad deal when I got into it. It was just the timing of it. We bought two car dealerships, ended up with three in the Central Valley and California, and they were great early on. They're like ATM machines early on when the economy is rolling. But as the economy started turning, you can guess what time frame this was. As the economy started turning downward and I was getting lied to, I basically had hired a bad employee that was lying to me, and kind of, he wasn't trying to steal from me. He was protecting his own you-know-what.
Sure.
So he wasn't giving me the truth, and I was absentee. That's another lesson. Don't ever be an absentee owner in anything. Right? So I was an absentee owner. I had all the money put into it, and I had hired somebody that was making terrible decisions and hiding me from them, so right. I couldn't get out. So all of a sudden, we started bleeding cash, and through a series of God events, was able to stop bleeding cash and get rid of them. But yeah, it was alarming how much money we lost in a very, very short amount of time. It's really the only bad business I've ever done.
Wow. That answers my next question. So the last question I have about finances is, you've got three kids.
Four, if you include Trevin, who's in heaven. Yes. Yeah.
How have you set them up for their future financially?
Yeah. I think something a lot of people aren't going to agree. I do not want to leave my kids a ton of money.
Sure.
That was never the goal. I want to leave my kids, private school, education money, club sports money, maybe, Sweet 16 car money.
Sure.
But I want my son-in-laws to provide for my daughters.
Sure.
I didn't want to leave my son-in-laws, who I love, by the way. They're amazing. Yeah. They're godsends. But that's their job to provide for the wives. That's not me.
Wow, that's good.
So we'd rather give it to kingdom purposes than leave it for our kids. Now, I'm not leaving them nothing. Like, they're going to be well taken care
Correct.
Of. But I don't want trust fund kids. I don't want them waiting for me to die so they can start cashing
collecting,
out and collecting and going on trips to, Turks and Caicos and buying Ferraris. So I'd much rather dig wells in Africa or feed the homeless in Birmingham or, support Church of Highlands or whatever it is. I'd rather go to kingdom building activities.
So you've already answered this question a little bit. So you said you were sitting there. When you say you said you were sitting in church and the hair on your arms was standing up because felt like the Lord saying you need to start doing this coaching. Tell me those steps. So you retire from analyst. What then?
All right. So I was the first of ESPN's big layoffs in 2017.
I remember that.
Yep. So they cut $100 million, and really they started with guys that made the most money. I had just signed my third contract and was doing very well, and met with the president, and he was like, hey, here's why. It's not a reflection on how you've done your job, blah, blah, blah. I can repurpose you. We can redo your deal. We can keep you. And I'm like, I'm kind of done with TV anyways. Well, he goes like, you have the golden parachute here. You got 3 years. It was like 2.5 years where we're going to pay your whole salary and you're not going to work for us. I had to sign, a non-compete and some other things. They don't want me going to Fox or whatever.
That's easy.
So I'm like, this is a no-brainer. Wasn't really enjoying it. The travel was wearing on me. I had lost my fastball. To be quite honest with you, I wasn't as good as I once was.
Why? Why, though? Because, you should have gotten
better. Because I wasn't as passionate about it. I think a lot of TV, when you're really good on TV, like I met with this person the other day. She's trying to get into TV, and And I knew within 4 minutes she was going to be a superstar. Mm-hmm. She had Maria Taylor. She had the best of the best. Katie George, who I think is a rock star right now. She has her written all over. Like, she's going to be a rock star. I knew in 4 minutes that she was going to be a star. Right? Because there's a charisma, there's an energy, there's a passion. Like, I can make the camera come to life if I really want to teach you something.
Right.
Right? Like, we just know how to do it.
Yeah.
That had become, well, the Cowboys and the Packers, and I was just kind of going through the motions. I was giving information. I wasn't living the information.
Right.
And all the focus groups and all the people that got back to the executive ESPN and told me what they liked about Trent was that I was animated, that I was passionate, that I could teach, that I could explain. You know, I could make, you know, a 3-minute segment come to life.
Make the camera come alive.
Make the camera come alive. Yeah. And know the red dots on you. For those of you know when you're on a one shot, when the red dot's on you. But not let the camera know, not let the audience know that the red dot's on you. Like, that's the art of TV. And it'd become just like checking the box. And I got, Steve Levy gave me great advice early in my TV career. He's like, okay, go back and watch yourself with the sound off and then turn your back to the camera and listen to yourself, the same segment. So if you do a 3-minute segment with me on SportsCenter, go back, DVR it, back then it's called DVR, DVR it, watch it with no sound. You'll see your mannerisms, you'll see how engaged you are, you'll see how engaged you are with the host, you know, you'll know if you're doing that part right. Then turn the sound on, turn your back to it, and listen. You'll understand if you're articulating your words, if your pace is right, if you're emphasizing the right things, if you're hitting the right spots, if, again, you're making your voice come to life.
Mm.
And I would do that for you because I cared about being good on TV. Sure. And when I cared, I would do it. Well, then late, like, I want to say it was like year 8, my wife goes, do you even like this anymore? I'm like, no, I don't. She goes, do the thing Levy used to have you do. Because she would watch me every once in a while, and she was too nice to say, but she goes, she ended up telling me, you're not nearly as good as you once were.
Wow.
And I did it, and I was like, ugh, that's not what I want to be. I'm like everybody else there.
Yeah.
You know, I never wanted to be like everybody else. So anyway, why did I start saying that? Why did we start going down that road?
No, the transition.
So I get the golden parachute.
Yeah.
So we get the golden parachute, and we're going to leave Northern California where he'd lived, where the kids gone to school, and we're going to move to Austin, Texas. And we were going to live kind of the bridge life. And buy this beautiful house on a lake, you know, kind of the walk-off, this is it type deal. I played 218 rounds of golf in 2018. Oh. I had knee replacement 2017, left knee replacement, and by the way, if you do it, it's the first month's awful, but after
my
that,
my best friend just had both his done.
Oh, the first 2 weeks is hell. The first month is rough, but after that, man, the no pain is amazing. I lived in pain for so long.
He had both done, Trent.
Oh.
And I saw a video this morning of him yesterday walking with a cane, and his walk was better, and he's 11 days out.
11. Oh, gosh. With both?
Both.
Oh, that's brutal.
11 days out, and he's walking better now than he did.
Yeah. So then
there's your commercial for getting your knee replaced.
Then I played golf 218 times in 2018, and I will always say this. It was so much fun. It was so much fun. Like, my life was fun. I don't believe God designed us to just live a life of fun. Mm. And I learned that the hard way. Wow. As a worse husband, as a worse father, I was a worse friend. Most importantly, I was a worse son.
Why?
Because
why?
I don't think
so much fun,
we weren't
why?
Designed for that.
Mm.
We were designed to serve. We were designed to give. We were designed to follow. We were designed to surrender.
Are we designed to work?
We're designed to work.
I agree.
We're not designed to have fun all the time. I think fun is good. I'm not saying fun is bad. We should have fun, you know. But that's not how we were designed. That's not how God made us.
Mm.
And after doing this for a couple years, in the midst of this, I had all these neat opportunities that were hitting my plate. And a lot of them were kind of ministry or servant driven, like sacrificial driven.
Sure.
And I kept saying, no, 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 no. And I am not an overly charismatic guy. If you put us like, I'm probably teetering on the charismatic. I'm probably a 6.
Okay.
But not an 8.
Fair enough.
I believe God speaks mainly to us through his word. Read your Bible. That's how God's going to speak to you the majority of the time. I do believe he speaks audibly to us through
his
spirit.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there. I can go to that pew tomorrow. I have no idea what the pastor said that day. Except, and my wife will vouch for this. She goes, why did you keep turning over your shoulder? I heard the Holy Spirit right here in my right ear, right behind me, saying, why do you keep saying no to me? Why do you keep saying no to me? Why do you keep saying no? And it was just, and it was that moment. I stayed after. I got on my knees. I said, Lord, I'm done saying no. Whatever it is, I don't know what you asked me to do, but I'm done saying no. I know I'm a worse son. I know I'm a worse husband. I know I'm a worse father. I know I'm a worse friend than I've been. I know I'm not following you the way I should be following you. What do you have for me? I went back and I told my youngest daughters in the house, my wife, we're going to China. And they go, what? I said, I know God's got to be calling us to China. I'm done saying no. That's got to be where he's calling us. No, he is calling us to Nashville, Tennessee to coach a high school football team that was literally a dust bowl at the time. And it was the most sacrificial thing I'd ever done. And that was my call into coaching.
Wow. So you go to Lipscomb. Is that where you
go to Lipscomb?
Go to Lipscomb, and that from Austin to Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah. Without my wife, without my daughter. Like, this was a true, like, this was the hardest thing we had done. They had to stay in Austin. My daughter had to finish high school.
How long did they stay?
So she ended up graduating early. It was originally going to be 18 months, ended up being 12 months.
Okay.
She graduated early and early enrolled. And okay. Then my wife moved up.
Wow. So you're in Nashville coaching a high school team. What made you think you were prepared to do that?
I wasn't at all. I think that, you know, I think, again, I really trust the leadership that hired me.
Sure.
They're awesome people, and I think they saw this too. But on paper, it's hire the sizzly guy with the Super Bowl ring, and you'll get admissions to go up. I mean, that's God, on paper. That's
God's
why you
honest
do
truth.
It. Yeah. Yeah. That's why they're still doing it. Yeah. Go up to Nashville right now. Who do they keep hiring? NFL players to drive private school admissions.
Wow.
Right? Because that's a hub of NFL activity. So, but I was the first, and maybe that was it on paper, but I walked in 36 kids on the roster, 6 lifted with a PVC pipe. They had raised $111,000 for the football program in 10 years. That's $11,000 a year for the football program.
Wow.
They didn't care about football.
This is a great school.
They didn't want anything to do with football except the president at the time had seen the dramatic, they were 77 under their admissions goal. And 2 years later, there's 150 person waiting list. Because of what football, not what I did, trust me, I'm the least of the story, but was able as the leader to bring a tribe of people in and create some energy and follow God's leading. And we built something out of the dust that had become pretty attractive. And pretty diverse. That was the other thing, too, is all of a sudden, you know, a school that had not had a black coach, all of a sudden had, I hired 13 my first year.
Wow.
You know, so all of a sudden you started seeing the demographic, you started seeing some challenging things that this school had not gone through before.
Yeah.
Now they're having to go through them and the beauty that comes out of that.
Where did the guy get that philosophy from? Because I think I know.
The guy that hired me?
Mm-hmm.
He was a basketball coach in Houston. And he had saw it happen in the school he was coaching at in Houston and really saw. And everybody says it because it's the front porch, right? Like that's the on paper answer. But he also saw that there was something else that needed to happen at that school. Mm. There was some reconciliation that needed to go on. There was some energy that needed to be brought into that. There was a purpose that place needed to have, a pride it needed to have again in its people. And I think through the vehicle of football, and also hired a great baseball coach who's still there at the same time, you know, also started making decisions to start support the arts. They built this incredible robotics
program.
They
spent money.
They spent money, and we raised money. And that was the other thing, too. He's like, you know, the one thing we haven't had is somebody that will go raise money. So they raised $111,000 in 10 years. We raised $1.1 in 93 days.
Wow.
We ended up raising $4 million in the time I was there.
What do you think? If you had to put a finger on the main reason that you guys won games, what would be the number one reason you turned it around?
I don't think it's that simple of an answer. I saw God's hand on all of it. But I'm also not going to be that Christian who goes, well, I just sat back in my chair and watched God
let
do
Jesus
everything.
Let Jesus do it all.
Yeah. Like we were very obedient to the directions he was taking us. I learned a long time ago, you see where God is moving and you join him.
Join him. Amen.
Right? You don't say, God, I'm going to go do this. Will you come join me? Yeah. No, God, I'm going to watch what you're doing, then I'm going to join you. We saw a thirst for diversity within the school and a thirst for kids that had never gone to Lipscomb before to want to come there.
Right.
And we're able to use football as a platform to make the school very attractive. You can't recruit high school at the high school level in Tennessee. But what you can do is you can make your visit very attractive once they choose to visit sure. there. So once they're on campus on their admissions tour, you might as well have called me Nick Saban or Dabo Sweeney.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're on campus, within the rules of the TSSAA, we are going to absolutely. Yeah. They wouldn't use that word for years because it was yeah. illegal. Now, it is illegal to recruit to bring them on campus.
But once
they choose to go through an admissions tour, oh, my gosh. We had the thing strategically laid out like we were a Power Four conference school.
That's right.
And we showcased the whole school.
Yeah.
Like we didn't just spend a ton of time in my office in the football facility. We spent time at the robotics center. We spent time with the coolest teachers. We spent time with a really cool vibe in kind of the quad area. We showed them all the different types of kids that go there. We saw all the different offerings. We showed how we want to holistically develop the child. Well, the mom all of a sudden is like, wait a second, my kid was going to go to this public school, but I can send my child here. We're
doing this.
And those kids' names now are at Vanderbilt, Tennessee, Missouri, Alabama, Auburn, you know, Iowa. I can go on and on and on. But at the time, they're eighth graders. Mm. You know, at the time, they're eighth graders looking for a place to have a great high school experience.
Right.
So, yeah, it's players. But it's once they, you know, just because he came as a really talented player in eighth grade, I'm not going to use any names, but now he's a ninth grader. He wasn't a very good football player at ninth grade.
No.
Where I will give ourselves, mainly my coaching staff, credit was the ability to take that really talented kid that still doesn't have the life skills probably necessary to be ultimately successful or uberly successful in life, and then holistically develop that child, both on and off the football field. And now we get these really great citizens that are really great football players, a team that's really, really good. And what we always say is kids are going to make impact when they're done playing football.
No, absolutely. What was the hardest part going from high school to college?
My answer, and I've been kicked in the groin this experience at UAB. My pride has been in a good way because the formatting of it's very similar. Because we ran the high school program so much like a college program,
okay.
Formatting the college program is pretty similar. But you amplify the drama by 100. And I think that's the thing that's been most difficult is little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. Little economics, little problems. Big economics, big problems.
What is the drama?
Every kid's issue, and I think this is the hardest thing about if you care more about just the wins and losses on the football field, every kid's issue has to become your issue.
Mm.
If you brush their issue aside and say, no, you're just a commodity that we use to win games, you may win more. I get why they do that. Like, I get why some of these ambition-driven and cutthroat win or die mentalities work because they basically just sequester all the issues and drama. That's somebody else's thing.
Mm.
I take it all in.
Yeah.
I did it in high school. I did it for my kids. I did it for my kids' teams. I did it for my high school team. I do it now here. Like if Johnny has a girlfriend issue, that became my issue because I have an open door policy. They come and talk to me like a father figure. I do this thing called coach hat, dad hat. So I'll put on the dad hat where all the coaching is off. I can be your dad now. Mm-hmm. Like I absorb that.
Yeah.
And that is that's complex. And then I think I also came in as this inflection point of college football.
You did.
That was like, really? That's not what I signed up for. That's not the college football I remember. Mm-hmm. That's not the, like, I don't get to coach that much. Now that's going to change this year. I'm making decisions right now. So I get to coach. My first 2 years, I did not coach very much.
Let me say this too. And I've been there. People think that you worked 14 days a year.
I get 14 days off a year.
The thing about college football is you set it beautifully. We are psychologists
yeah.
as much as we are coaches.
Yeah.
We are therapists as much as we are
mm-hmm.
teaching two high, single high, two high oh. safeties. And people don't really get that, because I will say this, Pat Sullivan had more as much impact on me as anyone in my life. He was my quarterback coach for 4 years at UAB.
Yeah.
Pat Sullivan taught me how to make a steak.
Yes.
So, like, and that's really simple.
Open a bank account.
All that.
Take care of your apartment.
All of it. So I sit there and I go, obviously, worn your hat. But people don't really understand that coaching is such a small part
yeah.
of college football. Such a small part.
It is. And it's become less, because the one thing, now we've added money, and I know at some point you're going to transition yeah. to NIL. Money has a golden rule in life. And some people are going to know this as it starts to come out of my mouth, and some, this is the first time you're hearing it, but you'll soak on this and you'll go, oh my gosh, this is a true statement. Money makes you more of what you were before you got it.
It just makes it larger.
Makes you more of whatever you were.
That's it.
Look who we're dealing with. We're looking for kids at one-parent households, maybe one of the greatest influences, lived in tough spots, had some tough breaks. Well, now we're giving them money, and it's amplifying all the bad habits.
Mm.
So when I said the drama goes up, we're amplifying all the issues
yeah.
by giving them money. I'm not saying money's a bad thing. I'm all for these kids being rewarded, but I do think we need to make sure that we're very careful with not just handing them money and saying, okay, now go figure it out. Like, we got to educate them through this process too. I think it's part of building a modern day team too. I think some of your better power fours that are winning are doing it, maybe not last year, but the years prior to that, those teams have done a good job of having some equity within how they pay their players mm-hmm. so it doesn't create that drama, some financial literacy as a priority within the program, some restraints on how they get the money, how the delivery mechanism is in place.
Yeah,
I hope that we get to a place where they actually don't get it all in cash. I hope that they get in terms of some long-term savings, not just, hey, here's 20 grand a month. Because we're amplifying the issues that some of these kids have coming into the programs, and we're not making sure that they can stay under our umbrella for 4 or 5 years so we can nurture through the process. They're unrestricted free agents twice a year, so they don't like the discipline we're trying to teach them. Well, they can bolt to where
they can go wherever they want.
Yeah.